Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we'll hear about the deadly bomb and gun assault in Kabul. The U.S. military presence in Iraq is being boosted to above 4,000. The prospects of a breakthrough in Syrian proximity talks dims. And there's a new movie about the tumultuous life of iconic trumpeter Miles Davis.
Miles did make a secret recording that was went missing. He was shot in a drive-by.
It's right here on The Voice of America. A group of Taliban insurgents staged a bomb and gun attack in the Afghan capital, Kabul, today. Reporter Ayaz Ghul joins us on the line from our South Asia Bureau in Islamabad. Welcome, Ayaz.
My pleasure.
What do we know so far about what happened?
Well, the latest details that the Interior Ministry in Kabul has just issued are that a Taliban suicide bomber driving a minibus packed with hundreds of kilograms of explosives hit a main entrance of the building, which basically houses security personnel mostly associated with the Afghan intelligence agency. And this massive explosion caused a lot of damage to the building, but it was so huge that it was heard across the Kabul city, according to witnesses. Most of the injuries that occurred were basically because of this massive explosion, because it's a busy place in Kabul, in the middle of the city, where, you know, it's difficult for the Afghan security to block the roads, because roads passing through this area actually lead to all parts of the city. So that is why it has caused a lot of casualties outside the building, because there were so many civilians either going to the offices, to their offices, or to work. But inside the building, after the explosion, there were at least two Taliban attackers who had explosives strapped to their bodies and were heavily armed. They entered the complex and they opened indiscriminate fire at people inside this building. A training was being conducted for Afghan security forces at the time of the attack, and that's where the Taliban attacker actually rushed to that particular area and opened fire. The latest details are that at least 30 people, including women and children, are among the dead, and more than 300 people have been wounded, according to health ministry officials in Kabul.
What has the Afghan president had to say about the raid?
He was quick to issue a statement this morning immediately after the attack to condemn it, and in the strongest terms, according to him. But he suggested that because the Taliban is suffering defeats in the battlefield elsewhere in Afghanistan, so they have resorted to this kind of a terrorist attack. So obviously there's widespread condemnation in Afghanistan from all sides, civil society, Afghan politicians, and other groups who are condemning it, because it apparently is one of the worst bombing in Kabul.
Thank you very much, Ayaz, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And joining us here in the studio with a look at what's being said online about this is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Susan. Good to be with you. But
thank
a sad
you.
Story to talk yeah. about with this Kabul blast. Kabul is a top trending topic on social media this morning worldwide, as is hashtag Kabul blast, hashtag Kabul attack. And the news really is spreading now on social media. We're seeing it kind of in real time as the death toll is rising. We're seeing those numbers reported sometimes first on social media before any of the articles are written or any of the stories are done. And we're seeing some scenes of the devastation as well.
And there's another big story today, and that is in U.S. politics in New York.
There is hashtag primary day. Of course, it's a Tuesday in the U.S.
Yes.
in the presidential election year, so there's got to be a primary. And New York is a big one for sure. It's, you know, certainly one of the biggest states, one of the most prominent states in the United States. So everybody's looking to New York today, doing their last-minute campaigning on social media. We just saw scenes not too long ago of Hillary Clinton voting in New York, of course, where she was a senator. So those scenes being shared on social media. And people using some of the tools we see on Twitter, they have a poll feature where people can put up a little poll. Now, it's obviously not a scientific poll because it's just going to be among their friends or whoever clicks on the hashtags that they use, but asking, who are you going to support today? looks like Donald Trump's going to run away with it. He's getting, yeah, in some polls, over 50% of the vote, while Ted Cruz and John Kasich are splitting the other half of the vote. So there's a lot of attention on the Democratic primary between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. People saying on social media, well, Hillary was the senator from New York, so if she can't win this state or do well in this state, there might be trouble for her. But people also looking at the time the polls close. They don't close until 9 p.m. New York time, which is very late. Usually polls close around, you know, 7 o'clock. So people saying, oh, I got to wait 2 extra hours to stay up and watch the results. So people not too pleased about that.
Well, a little lost sleep won't hurt them.
No, I guess not.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
New research suggests radioactive bits of a star that exploded in a nearby supernova showered the Earth and Moon eons ago. The stellar evidence was found in concentrations of an isotope of iron called 60Fe. Researchers say the star that produced the telltale isotopes was about 300 light years away from us, a relatively close distance, when it exploded about 2 million years ago. To make their findings, the researchers analyzed lunar samples gathered by several of the Apollo missions from the 1960s and 1970s. They also gathered sediment and crust from the bottom of the Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian Oceans. The team found that the stars that produced the 60Fe isotopes would have been close enough to Earth to be seen during the day when they exploded, shining with a brightness comparable to the moon. Fortunately, no humans in our modern form as Homo sapiens would have been around to see the event. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United States is boosting its military presence by about 200 additional troops in Iraq as security forces battle to retake the northern city of Mosul, controlled for the past 2 years by Islamic State fighters. The announcement came in a statement in Baghdad by Defense Secretary Ashton Carter.
We are going to place additional advisors with the Iraqi security forces now down to brigade and battalion headquarters. We're going to make available attack helicopters in support of the ISF's ongoing efforts to envelop and then retake Mosul. We're going to provide financial assistance to the Peshmerga to bolster what has been, namely the Peshmerga, one of the most effective fighting forces against ISIL.
The announcement boosts the U.S. military presence in Iraq to above 4,000, the highest number since U.S. forces left the country in 2011. On the CBS television network, President Obama said he reflects the growing ability of Iraqi forces to confront the IS group.
As we see the Iraqis willing to fight and gaining ground, let's make sure that we're providing them more support. We're not doing the fighting ourselves, but when we provide training, when we provide special forces who are backing them up, when we are gaining intelligence, working with the coalitions that we have, what we've seen is that we can continually tighten the noose. My expectation is that by the end of the year, we will have created the conditions whereby Mosul will eventually fall.
Mr. Obama's spokesman, John Ernst, was asked if the slow buildup of American forces in Iraq reflects the kind of mission creep that occurred in Vietnam 50 years ago.
This is a classic case of the president asking his team to develop ways to intensify those elements of our strategy that have shown some progress. And we know that Iraqi forces fighting ISIL on the ground in Iraq have benefited tremendously from the advice and assistance that they've received from U.S. service members that have accompanied them. And what we have sought to do is to develop a strategy that would allow us to offer more advice and to offer greater assistance that does not, however, put American service members automatically on the front lines. I'm not seeking to downplay the significant risk that our service members are taking in Iraq. We've already seen a couple of U.S. service members killed in Iraq. What they're doing is quite dangerous.
He insisted their mission is quite different from the one President George W. Bush launched with 100,000 troops in 2003. Regional analyst Peter Bechtold of Oregon State University, a former State Department official, told VOA's Victor Beatty he is uneasy about this buildup.
I'm old enough to remember Vietnam. I'm old enough to remember previous policies around the world where you start small and you say we have to back up the Iraqi armed forces in this case. And so the question is, why has the Iraqi armed forces not become stronger in the last decade? What difference are 200 American special forces advisors going to make?
Islamic State has been in control of Mosul, the northern city, for about 2 years. Yes. They've got to be entrenched. It's going to be a very difficult battle.
Yes, indeed. And not only that, you might have seen the report in the Washington Post, which was an analysis of a very comprehensive survey of what the various people want, including the ones in Mosul, and they said they don't want to be liberated. It's not that they like the Islamic State. They don't like them, but they don't want to be liberated by either the Iraqi army or by the Peshmerga Kurdish fighters.
The fall of Mosul, would that spell the end of Islamic State in Iraq?
I'm not sure. You know, the Islamic State in Iraq is not so much a physical event as it is a combination of two things. On the one hand, you have the very disaffected Sunni Arabs, and they are the backbone of what became the Islamic State in Iraq, which then renamed itself Islamic State when similar groups in Syria joined them. The other side of the Islamic State is the notion by outsiders, many of them from Central Asia and from other faraway places, from Tunisia, North Africa, and so on, who are there because they believe in a concept, in an idea, that the failed state system of the past half century should be replaced by something more similar to what existed in the Ottoman Empire. That is to say, a caliphate where you have a ruling authority that lives by Sharia law. If ISIS is a threat, first and foremost a threat to the neighboring states, Syria, the Alawis, and in Iraq by the Shia. And beyond that, they are a threat to Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And they are not the ones who are fighting. And yet our government seems to think they are a threat.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest said U.S. strategy remains that the fight has to be led by local forces with the support and assistance of the United States and coalition partners. Coming up on International Edition, hopes dim for Syrian peace talks, and a dark film about a famous trumpeter. The prospects of a breakthrough in proximity talks in Geneva on Syria's political future has dimmed with announcement that the opposition is suspending its formal participation with the government delegation. The chief negotiator for the High Negotiations Committee, Mohamed Alouche, said its suspension is the result of the deteriorating security and humanitarian situation in Syria. He said the ceasefire was effectively ended by the Damascus regime, detailing Russian-led airstrikes and the presence of Iranian reinforcements. UN envoy to Syria, Stefan de Mistura, said the talks would continue at a lower level.
I heard today their intention to postpone their formal participation in the Palais to the negotiations in order to express their own displeasure and concern on the humanitarian situation degradation and on the problems related to the cessation of hostilities. They told us, however, their intention to remain in Geneva and possibly, at my own suggestion, to pursue technical discussions with myself and my team, particularly on the issues related to Resolution 2254 and the political transition.
De Mistura said on Friday the participants will take stock of the discussions, review what they have come up with, and then decide on how and when to move forward. Rebels say government-backed forces are trying to retake the northern city of Aleppo as the talks take place. Opposition fighters say they launched their own offensive against government forces in the country's northwest. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity College in San Antonio, Texas, says this is the result of a complicated truce where indirect talks are underway at the same time forces on the ground are allowed to continue to attack militants, such as the Nusra Front and Islamic State.
You have various groups trying to establish themselves and establish an advantageous position regarding negotiations. Certainly the Syrian government, supported by the Russians, have always seen this as a situation where they engage in the negotiations without a real any intention of coming to any sort of conclusion because they have been on the uptick lately militarily. They have the advantage. You know, when there is asymmetry, when there is an unequal situation between the negotiating partners, it really doesn't make for any sort of agreement or certainly a sustainable agreement. And so the High Negotiation Committee of the opposition is not in a situation where they can be a party to negotiations when they're at a disadvantage.
We asked if the Syrian government is serious about a desire to negotiate a resolution to the conflict.
The Syrian government has taken advantage of the cessation of hostilities, as the Syrian opposition has tried to take advantage of it. But the Syrian government, supported by the Russians, Iranians, and Hezbollah, is in a much more advantageous position to push on offensively, militarily. And that's what they're doing. They did so in retaking Palmyra, and now they're doing so in trying to retake Aleppo, the largest city in Syria. This is not a situation that was unforeseen. And I think the Syrian opposition, hoping that the superpowers, Russia and the United States, would use their combined diplomatic power to compel the Syrian government to cease and desist, it's not working.
The White House said U.S. and Russian top leaders spoke by phone, and they agreed to continue forging closer coordination on Syria, including through their intelligence services and defense ministries.
What the United States and Russia are trying to do is to maintain the fiction of the cessation of hostilities, or at least to maintain a lessening of the war that existed before the cessation of hostilities that creates the political space for negotiations.
But David Lesh says, despite this setback, the fact that the main opposition delegation remains in Geneva suggests both sides want a political settlement and will take the UN, Russia, and the U.S. to come up with the formula that is acceptable to both sides. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
One of the best ways to help the environment may be to simply use what you already have. And that includes food. About a third of the world's food goes to waste, according to the UN Environment Program. But an organization in Israel is trying to change that by collecting fruits and vegetables not attractive enough to sell.
What we're doing is helping to utilize them, and instead of throwing them, to give them to people that need them.
Oren Hershkovitz volunteers with the organization Leket, which distributes food to the poor throughout Israel. Kitty Crouch is the CEO of Leket and wants the government to set standards in the food industry to cut waste. In the meantime,
we can rescue about 8 billion shekels worth of food.
Crouch says he wants Israel to adopt the UN goal of reducing food waste by 50% within the next 15 years. That would put more food on the table for those who need it and keep less of it out of the landfills. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbee.
Actor Don Cheadle is making his directorial debut with his film drama Miles Ahead, which looks at the tumultuous life of iconic trumpeter Miles Davis. Cheadle focuses on the musician's visceral talent, inner demons, and sense of humor in a film noir type of thriller, complete with car chases, shootouts, and drug addiction. VOA's Penelope Palou has the story.
If you gonna tell a story, come with some attitude, man.
Attitude is at the core of this Miles Davis biopic.
I want it to be gangster. I want it to be wild. I want it to be impressionistic.
Miles Davis. My name's Dave Braden, Rolling Stone magazine.
I'm here to do your comeback story.
Okay, move back a little bit.
Yeah.
The film portrays Davis in the late 1970s during his fallow period, a recluse with physical ailments and a cocaine addiction.
It's based on a lot of incidents, you know, like any biopic. There, you know, characters are composites and they're amalgams. A lot of that stuff happened, you know. Miles did make a secret recording that was, went missing. He was shot in a drive-by. He had many reporters coming to him during this period of time trying to get the story.
This is madness. I am not dying over this jazz tape.
don't call it jazz, man. That's a made-up word. It's social music.
Through flashbacks, the film juxtaposes an older, paranoid Davis with his younger, confident, though arrogant self, at the top of his game. We learn of his emotional dependence on his then-wife, talented dancer, Frances Taylor, and his abusive behavior towards her, both physically and emotionally.
I need you.
Tittle does not sugarcoat Davis's transgressions. He loves the music icon for who he was and portrays him as a soft-spoken yet intense character. Ewan McGregor, who interprets the reporter shadowing Davis, grounds the fraying icon to present-day reality. Tittle calls his teaming with Ewan McGregor a great artistic experience, but also a necessary pairing with a white star so he could get his film off the ground.
I would have more difficulty financing it unless the actor that I picked had an international appeal. And having Ewan McGregor and sell to the UK was a huge piece of the pie that we needed in order to get the ball rolling.
On the heels of the Oscars' so-wide controversy, Tittle neither defends nor chastises the industry. A pragmatist and a celebrity himself, he sees Hollywood as a big business, averse to risk and fear-based.
You're black?
That does not mean he defends its typecasting stereotypes. Hollywood, he says, does not take purposeful aim against blacks and other minorities, but its decisions, he says, can lead to racism and bias all the same. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at a seminar in Botswana's Ganzi district in early April, U.S. Ambassador to Botswana Earl Miller called Botswana a laudable example for other countries to follow. Now, Botswana could be among the first countries to actually control the HIV epidemic. The seminar was organized by an interagency team from the U.S. government in partnership with the District Multisectoral AIDS Committee. The U.S. also partnered with the Media Institute of Southern Africa. This program was sponsored by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, which is the country's global health initiative to assist countries in responding effectively and sustainably to the HIV epidemic. Over the last decade, PEPFAR has committed more than $780 million to Botswana in its response to HIV. Together with the government of Botswana, civil society, and other development partners, we have come a long way, Ambassador Miller noted. Ambassador Miller lauded Botswana's progress toward meeting UNAIDS Global 90-90-90 targets, referring to the HIV testing, treatment, and viral suppression targets. 90% of those infected with HIV should be aware of their status, 90% of those aware of their status should have received treatment, and for 90% of those being treated, the drugs will have had the intended effect of suppressing the patient's viral load. A study sponsored by PEPFAR found that out of the 3,500 individuals from 30 communities who tested HIV positive, 83% of them knew their HIV status. Among people who knew their HIV status, 87% of them had initiated treatment, and 96% of those on the treatment had achieved viral suppression. This was only a relatively small sample size in just 30 communities, but it is encouraging. Ambassador Miller commended the government of Botswana for considering the adoption of the test and treat policy. Moving towards earlier initiation of treatment is strongly supported by a recent international randomized clinical trial, he said. Treatment also acts as prevention by lowering the risk of transmission to uninfected sexual partners. Now is the time to redouble our efforts and together run to and through the finish line.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Thank you.